What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, Peter Dunworth, in the building. Just kidding, not in the building, over Zoom. But we discuss his outrageous claim to have $10 billion per Bitcoin. See how he gets the math there and see why it's maybe not so outrageous. Then we dive into the overall macro economy a little bit, his experience in personal finance, and that aspect of things, bringing TradFi to Bitcoin, and much, much more. So be sure to tune in for another action-packed episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, big shout-out to my sponsor down at PlebLab in Austin, Texas. They've got some of the best hacker courses that you can take in order to become a developer, whether it's Noster. I know they're working on another Pleb Dev course. If you want to become a developer, that's the number one hacker space in the game. You can pay with everything on Oshi, get some sats back. It's an absolutely great place. So check them out at pleblab.com. Go buy something, buy a ticket, support the boys down there. And help PlebLab out. Also, shout out to my homie Corey at Hodler's Official. Hodler's Official makes amazing, amazing baseball jerseys for Team Bitcoin. They got another line coming out here in the very near future. But help buy that Genesis starter pack, right? They got the white or black Bitcoin baseball jerseys with the number 9 Satoshi for the Genesis block baseball jerseys. So you can go to their website, hodlersofficial.com, use promo code GREENCANDLE, one word, you get 10% off your entire order. All right. And lastly, not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast is not financial advice and should not be taken as financial advice. All right. Enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Peter Dunworth in the building, who has made a very, very bold claim. So I'm going to have to start right off the bat and jump right in. But, you know, you're the man that has claimed that you think that a $10 billion Bitcoin is a bearish thesis and it just has to happen. So let's hear it, man. Let's hear the thesis. Why do you think $10 billion per coin is in the near future?
I understand how absurd that sounds when we put it that way, and given that price, it's the 17th of October today and price is sitting at around 28,000, 29,000 US, you look at that and think, well, that's a long way from where it is. But very simply, this is an asset that we completely misunderstand, and no one really has an appreciation for what this thing represents and what it can do. And there's a breakdown of this valuation framework that we put together on this is that, you know, when thinking about money and how to value assets, it's very difficult to value Bitcoin because it doesn't fold into any of the traditional forms or realms of valuing assets. You know, most people look at it and think, oh, well, it could be gold, so let's try and value it on a supply-demand curve. It's impossible to value it from an internal rate of return perspective because there's no rate of return on it. So it's like, well, how do you value that? And then to me, what's interesting is that Bitcoin has, say, 3 or 4 technical innovations that have never happened before, which are a one-time, you know, once-off invention that we've never seen before. So how do we actually value the ability to use those things moving forward? So just very, very quickly on that valuation framework, the 4 tech innovations I think that Bitcoin brings to the table, which are completely new to our species, is firstly, it provides absolute digital scarcity. That's a one-off invention that's never happened before, and people have talked ad nauseum on that. Secondly, we have seizure resistant, which is really important. This is the first asset that can't be seized, and you know, there are some wonderful magical things that you can do with an asset that you can't seize, but you know, we're only new to this. We're the first generation to it, so we don't really comprehend what that means yet. Thirdly, there's the censorship resistance aspect to it, which for the first time in human history, we have the ability that if you've got access to the network, you can't be stopped from sending something. That's never happened before either. And then the big one, which is probably the most boring talking point, but for me, this is where most of the juice is that this is the first time in history we've had an immutable ledger supply and issuance. So if you break that down into probably the most helicopter of thoughts, you know, we are now entering the third iteration of human evolution. We had the pre-written word up until caveman, and then we had the written word, which started with cave paintings and ended with digital, you know, recordings of what we've got now. But they were malleable. And now we have recorded word, which is basically an immutable ledger that will go on in time forever. So it's the third era of humanity, and we don't really understand what that brings. So why talk about that tech innovation, why it's so critical for forming some form of valuation around Bitcoin is, if you look at the functions of money, there are three functions of money. There's store of value, mean of exchange, unit of account. And up until now, there's never been a single asset that can do it all. You know, typically store of value is gold. Mean of exchange has been dominated by the US dollar. And then the unit of account was, well, basically has been the double entry ledger system. Now, fast forward to the introduction of Bitcoin, we now have one asset that is the best at all those three functions of money at the same time. And so what that does from an economic perspective is bring a very different dynamic to this asset, because what you have is, because of those tech innovations, it basically improves the store of value function, which has typically been gold. But now, because you've got absolute digital scarcity rather than a 2% inflation rate, which gold has, it's going to be way more valuable than gold. And when you couple that with seizure resistance, all of a sudden, this is a superpower for a store of value. Then when you look at medium exchange, and objectively, it's not better than, you know, the US dollar at the moment, because the US dollar out trades at, you know, a million to one on a daily basis. But it will be better because it's got censorship resistance and it's got an immutable issuance and supply. Whereas the US dollar, it's just pick a number and they'll do whatever they want. They'll increase supply by 40%, they'll reduce it by 7%, depending on what year and what they want to do. And then the third function, the unit of account, we've got a double entry ledger system, which is what people use at the moment. But we now have an immutable ledger, so people are going to want to use an immutable ledger rather than a malleable ledger, because, you know, if you want a record, you want a record. You know, you want to make sure of something, it's got to be on the Bitcoin blockchain, not anything else. So when you look at those three, you know, or those four innovations, how they apply to the functions of money, this is where it gets really interesting, because most people think that, oh, well, what we do is we're going to add the market caps of store of value, medium exchange, unit of account, and we're going to get to the total value or addressable market of Bitcoin. And now if you look at that, it's 10 trillion in gold, roughly 100 trillion in USD, and 2,000 trillion in unit of account. Add those together, you get to $2.1 quadrillion. Divided by 21 million, you get to $100 million a coin. To me, that is not rational thinking. Well, that's perfectly rational thinking if you don't understand what those new functions of money mean and how Bitcoin applies to it. But when you understand that Bitcoin's the best at store of value, medium exchange, and unit of account, what I call the first triple point asset. It's the first time in history we've had one asset that dominates all three functions of money at the same time. We're going to have competitive tension across each of those functions of money for access to Bitcoin. So you're going to have store of value competing with medium exchange, competing with unit of account, all for that precious space on the blockchain. So what does this mean? Rather than thinking of Bitcoin and the market cap is going to be an accretive value, it's not. It's going to be an exponential value where you need to multiply that together, because you've got competitive tension competing for that single asset. And we've never had those three silos of functions of money where we've had one asset to rule them all. And now we do. And so when you look at that, you know, a crazy valuation of $10 billion a coin makes a whole lot more sense when you put it into that context.
Yeah. And the other question I have for you too, is that is a lot of things that you talked about, you know, a lot of things that you talked about in there kind of takes the power away from like governments, you know, like kind of the central bodies that we have right now. And does your current model, I guess, like, you know, the $10 billion, the shot that you're calling, does it account for, you know, maybe the potential of, I guess, more money printing, some other, you know, like various inflation factors that we have, like that are, you know, I guess, going on right now? And, you know, I guess another question stemming from that is, you know, I guess we're at a point where it's going to, I don't know. I feel like the people in power, at least in the United States government right now, are going to have a tough time kind of giving up that power. So where do you see, I guess, the biggest roadblocks going forward with, I guess, one, like dealing with the potential inflationary factors that we have in the current system, and two, like, you know, avoiding that, I guess, potential to try to confiscate and try to, you know, the U.S. government trying, or not only the U.S., but all other governments trying to make it difficult to hold Bitcoin?
I think it's easy to get caught up in the negativity of, you know, the competition between government and Bitcoin. And, you know, I look at a shining light example of this in El Salvador, that they've adopted and embraced Bitcoin, and look what that's done for the country. It's helped weed out a whole host of graft or grift and corruption. It's enabled them to create a safe environment. It's enabled them to get their financial house in order. It's created an opportunity for an increased volume of tourism and interest from around the world. It's reminiscent of maybe the early days of Singapore, when Singapore was, you know, just getting its feet and sort of redefining itself out of a little island just off Malaysia to, you know, fast forward 80 years and it's a, you know, an economic powerhouse that's bigger than Switzerland. It depends. I'd like to go through the, you know, the collaborative environment with the government, where we all work together for the benefit of everyone. And this is where a willingness to adopt Bitcoin can have a dramatic improvement across all society. So I think there are a lot of smart people in government who are going to look at this and think, this is really a cheat code for us to fast forward our progress and, you know, deliver a whole host of things for, you know, for the communities and for the people that we serve. And I look at El Salvador as a shining light on that. And I think it's only a matter of time before the governments realize, hey, we've got an opportunity to do something here. Maybe it's not as bad as we thought it was initially. Maybe it's not really for drugs and Silk Road, and, you know, maybe money launderers aren't money laundering at all, because, you know, the funny thing about that is it's an immutable ledger. So the whole idea of money laundering with an immutable ledger seems absolutely absurd to me. So as this fear, uncertainty and doubt gets broken down around Bitcoin, I think there's going to be a much greater willingness for governments to adopt it. And they're going to be able to leverage, you know, the programs and the desires that they want to achieve for their communities against the Bitcoin network and actually achieve better outcomes. So I think it's going to be a symbiotic relationship rather than a clash of ideologies. I think there's going to be a lot of smart people in government who realize, well, if we actually work with this, we can actually get a whole lot more. So that's my hope, that governments embrace it and can work with it.
All right. Yeah. So you answered that question beautifully, and I appreciate that. But you also work a little bit more on, like, I guess, the traditional finance side. So I kind of want to dive into that right now, because you brought up El Salvador, and, you know, I don't know how much of my content you've checked out, but I do talk to a lot of the traditional, you know, financial people here. You know, maybe they manage hedge funds or something like that in the United States. And the general narrative I feel around there is that, you know, El Salvador's, you know, movement to Bitcoin was not great, because if you look at the dollar amount of Bitcoin when they started buying in and, you know, where it's at now, they've, you know, on paper lost money. And so, you know, I guess when you talk to traditional people, you know, kind of coming in, maybe it's their first exposure to Bitcoin, you know, do you kind of get that as like a negative talking point or a negative narrative around Bitcoin, where, you know, the volatility might scare some of them off?
Yes and no. And if volatility is scaring people off, I think it's a weighting issue. So by that, I mean, if someone's really concerned about volatility, what they're concerned or what they're really saying to you is they're not comfortable putting as much money in as what you think they should. So, you know, to put this in relative terms that we all understand, if, you know, if you're going to put 1% of your net wealth into Bitcoin, you know, with all due respect, and anyone across any circumstance probably really isn't going to care too much about losing 1% of their wealth. But if you're talking about putting 50% of your wealth in, then all of a sudden that's a much heavier conversation for someone to, you know, process cognitively, to think, hang on a sec, this volatility, I'm not prepared to put 50% of my net assets into an asset that has the volatility that Bitcoin does. So I think when having that conversation, a really good place to start is with people is to, encourage learning about Bitcoin, because the more you know, the more you'll buy. And secondly, have a conversation around what's the number that they can sleep with at night. So when it comes to investing, you know, you don't want to be putting people into assets that keep them up at night. That's not what investing is about. Investing is about being able to sleep well at night and know that, you know, you've got assets that are going to protect you. And so if people are losing sleep about Bitcoin, their asset allocation, their weighting to Bitcoin is clearly too high, or their knowledge isn't enough, like isn't high enough. So one of those things needs to be adjusted. You either adjust the weighting to Bitcoin and lower it, or alternatively, you start learning about Bitcoin so you can get comfortable with the weighting that you hold.
Gotcha. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I mean, you probably deal with a lot of people in various locations. So, you know, another question that comes to mind is, does it vary based on, I guess, maybe the opinion of Bitcoin, or maybe some of the worries that clients that of yours that come in, based on like geographical location? Maybe it's, you know, whatever underlying fiat currency that the country that they reside in uses, or something along those lines. Like, do you kind of, I guess, I don't know, can kind of almost anticipate what some of the worries are based on the geographical location a client comes in from?
Yes, that's a very, very good point, because in discussing this with literally clients all over the globe, it really gets broken down into two specific functions. It's either a need or a want. And in the Western world, Bitcoin is a want. It's a desire. It's a nice to have. Whereas in the third world countries, Bitcoin is a need. It's like oxygen, water, shelter, and Bitcoin. It's a much higher weighting to what they need. So for adoption levels, that's fantastic, because it means third world's going to adopt this probably a lot faster than the first world. But for the first world, then it really comes down to a speculation on, oh, it's an investment and it's a nice part of the portfolio. They don't understand that, you know, if I sort of quote one of your famous American sales trainers, Zig Ziglar. He said that money is not the most important thing on earth, but it is damn close to oxygen. And the Western world doesn't really understand that Bitcoin is the best money ever invented, and they're getting swindled every day they hold onto their existing fiat. But the third world's very conscious of that, and they understand that it's a need, not a want, to have Bitcoin, because it's the best asset for preserving purchasing power.
Then what is it going to take, do you think, for that Western mindset to change? Is it something that, like, a complete and total collapse? Do you think we're kind of on the process there? Or, do you think it's just going to, what's the next step in order to get the Western world to try to catch up to, I guess, the mindset of the third world?
I think the third world operates from a very fearful perspective, in that, you know, the need is driven very, very clearly by a desire of fear, because if you don't have this hard currency, or the US dollar, which is a relative hard currency to their currencies, they miss out on eating the next day. That is a very, you know, short-term thinking that enables them to have a very sharp focus, or a desire, not a desire, it is a need, if they want to eat tomorrow, to have this. The flip side of this is, with the Western world, there are two drivers for, you know, at our very base layer. Our reptilian brains basically run off two things. It's greed and fear. And so we either run from something or run to something. The third world, I believe, is running from something, a shitty currency to a hard currency. The first world, though, is going to be running to something, in that they want the greed component. They want the number to go up. So they're going to look at this and say, this is a great investment. This is a way for me to buy a lottery ticket that I can cash in 10 years time. And it's a sure winner. So I look at the motivators from, say, the third world is typically, it's a need. It's, you know, a must have, whereas the Western world is a nice to have. And then the way to, you know, for people to adopt that is to think that there's huge gains in front of them. And this is where the next 2 years is going to get very interesting, because we're probably going to see a huge spike in price, and that sets off a whole new cycle of the Western world jumping in and buying at the top again.
Yeah, for sure. And part of, like, I guess the new maybe you can describe a little bit more of what you do and things like that. But it seems like, the thought around that is more like time locking Bitcoin, so to speak. So, putting it away, cold storage, like not really touching it for a certain period of time. You mentioned obviously the next 2 years are going to be very interesting. Obviously, we got the halving, and that's essentially coming up in a recession. Theoretically, because there's a lot of various macro factors that are starting to show cracks, not only in the United States but globally here. Let's line out the next 2 years. Like, how do you think this is going to play out? Do you think, I know you called your shot with the $10 billion Bitcoin, but how soon do we get there? Like, where do you see the next steps in, I guess, the debasement of fiat currency kind of over this next couple of years?
Well, I think we're going to continue to see debasement. We're going to continue to see inflation as well. So, debasement and inflation, some people confuse those terms, but I think one is a function of the other and actually compounds the other. So not only do you get kind of rolled over on debasement, which you don't really understand or see, but then you actually see it, manifest in physical terms through inflation when you go to purchase things. So I think those themes are going to continue to go on. I'm looking at this on from two sides of the equation. We've got a demand and supply when we look at price and to think what happens. And to get very myopic on this, and then we can expand to say the geopolitical and macro events that are happening around this. But if we drill down into the demand for Bitcoin, what's coming up, I look at the fact that we've got a number of ETFs coming up. There's roughly $50 trillion of assets under management from firms who have applied for an ETF. I've got to think that they're going to start with a 1 to 2% allocation into Bitcoin over the next 3 years. A 1 to 2% allocation of that $50 trillion means we're going to see somewhere between $500 billion to $1 trillion come into a market that has a market cap of $500 billion now. So what that means is we're going to have an exponential price rise when that money comes through the door. In addition to that, we've got a halving, which I think has less effect on things now. It's more a psychological effect that's going to happen in April next year. We've got huge amounts of investment happening in the mining front. We've got supply coming off the exchanges. Like for the first epoch, we've actually had Bitcoins coming off exchange. So we've seen from 2019, I think it is, or maybe 2020 to now, we've had over 1 million coins come off exchange. I expect that to continue. And what we have here is a perfect, demand supply curve where we're setting ourselves up for an exponential shift upwards. And this is where, the demand can come from all sorts of places. We're looking at ETF demand, but the things that aren't really talked about where I think will be huge demand moving forward are, I think there's going to be government demand for it for their global reserves, or their, foreign reserves. They'll have to hold that. There's going to be corporate treasuries that are going to look at it. We've got the Fair Accounting Standard Board that are going to change the rules in 2025, which means they can put it on the balance sheet and not be penalized for it. We've got the banks in Europe that have a the ability to hold 2% of their assets in crypto slash Bitcoin. There are so many demand points for this, and I look at this and I think there's just a weight of money coming into the space that we can't really comprehend what that's going to do, particularly on a limited supply because there's only 2 million coins on exchange. So if we get $1 trillion come into the space in the next few years, we've only got 2 million coins on exchange, and really only 1 million of those are for sale. All of a sudden, that $1 trillion needs to fit into 1 million coins, and all of a sudden, that's $1 million Bitcoin, give or take. So there's a huge amount of demand coming in from a from a micro level. If we look at the macro level, well, the world's in turmoil at the moment. We've got we've got a whole host of long-term bonds going no bid, which means the price of bonds is crashing and the yields are going through the roof. At some point in time, they're going to, what it looks like to me is that the Federal Reserve is going to have to end up buying all of those. And then they'll flick the switch and start dropping the rates. And everyone thinks we've got a debt problem, but this is going to be the greatest rugging anyone's ever rugged. You've got the Federal Reserve owning all the long-term bonds at a really high yield. The second they start dropping the rates and normalizing them way down to, the zero bound, all of a sudden, they've made a fortune on these long-term bonds. Everyone wants to buy them, and they've solved their debt problem. So the debt problem, there's 1 million ways they can get out of this, and I just never underestimate their ability to get out from under a problem when they control all the rules. Like, they literally are the banker. Like, you know, if you want to, you know, if you go to the, you know, the casino, the only job you want is to be, you know, the house, because the house always wins. And this is what I think, you know, we forget as participants in this market, thinking it's a free and fair market. Like, if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. It's not a free and fair market. It's complete horseshit, pardon the French. But and this is where Bitcoin represents a complete change to that. And then, you know, you look at that situation happening, potential ability to lower interest rates, and then the need for liquidity to come in on top. All of a sudden, it's setting us up for, dare I say it, another shot at that elusive super cycle for Bitcoin.
Another shot, or are you saying that it's going to happen? I need the definite answer here, Peter.
Yeah, I'll give you probability. I think we've got probably a 40% chance of a super cycle where it just goes away and keeps going. And if I break this down, I'd say we've got a 40% chance of it happening in the next cycle, 40% in the next cycle, and 20% or 10% and 10% for the next cycle. So that gives us the full range of probability. So I'd say a 40% chance of that happening.
Okay. I mean, that's fair. I had to put you on the spot. You brought it up, so I had to do it. But, you know, you mentioned about governments, you know, essentially adopting it over time, right? I mean, obviously we've seen El Salvador. They've done the whole, you know, volcano bond situation. I can't remember the exact details as to when that's rolling out or whatnot. But, you know, it seems like on paper, it's been very successful from El Salvador. So I'm curious, as you're talking to, you know, clients around the world, you're kind of keeping your eye on this kind of thing. How many more countries do you think are going to start to develop some sort of Bitcoin framework, whether it's, you know, backing bonds with Bitcoin, or, you know, making Bitcoin legal tender, the various ways a government could kind of, I guess, maybe dip their toe in or fully jump into to the whole Bitcoin world?
Well, I think it's going to be a matter of time. I think everyone's going to do it. It's just a matter of when they're going to adopt it. And, you know, to the victor go the spoils. So early adopters will be rewarded in a much higher way than for people who are coming in late to the party, as what happens, you know, for early adopters of Bitcoin. It'll be the same for the nation state. The other thing that I think is going to be really interesting is, and this is, you know, from a high level macro perspective, everyone's talking about the de-dollarization, where the US dollar is going to, you know, fade away in insignificance. And I just don't think that's happening. I think that is, the world is going to re-dollarize before it de-dollarizes. And a stable coin on Bitcoin is going to be the catalyst for global adoption of Bitcoin, which is unpalatable to some Bitcoin maxis thinking, why are we using the US dollar to do that? But the US dollar is still the best currency globally, ex Bitcoin. And people understand that and have all of the contracts denominated in US dollars, or the majority of global trades denominated in US dollars. So I actually see it being a symbiotic relationship where the US dollar is actually going to be spread to, you know, the four corners of the earth, and very closely followed by Bitcoin to leverage the Bitcoin network to do that. So I think it's going to be symbiotic, whether people like it or not. I just think that's the way it's going to work, and then Bitcoin will overtake in time.
Then what do you, I guess, think about, you know, I don't know if you're how closely you're following the U.S. presidential race, but, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr. has come out and said that if he's elected, you know, he would back the dollar with, you know, hard assets, not only Bitcoin, but also real estate, gold, and other kind of things. So I'm not sure, you know, how, I guess, he would be able to pull that off. But, you know, I guess, what do you take of that as your theory is kind of lining out? Do you think that, I guess, is a general possibility? Or do you think that, you know, maybe some other country might come in, maybe BRICS or some of these other type of countries, and I guess line out more of an in-between currency, in between, I guess, the fiat system, and then this in-between before we get to fully a Bitcoin standard?
You know what, that's a really good question. If I can just sort of think about this for a second, I think the highest probability of this happening is going to be from the commodity producing nations, because they understand what it means to produce something and be paid for it. And this is where Bitcoin most closely aligns as a currency with a commodity and with the commodity. So, you know, to mine gold, to mine for, you know, drill for oil or gas or, you know, whatever commodity you may be thinking of requires a huge amount of energy and work. And the same is said for, you know, mining Bitcoin or finding a hash. There's a huge amount of work to it. So I think there's going to be an intrinsic link to those commodity producers and those countries being the first to understand and adopt Bitcoin. Because I look at, say, the oil and gas producing nations, they're probably going to be the first to adopt it, I think, because I think there's an evolution of this that's going to start with, they're going to start mining Bitcoin. And I think we've already seen a lot of countries do that, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Qatar, was it Yemen? I'm not sure, maybe, but Russia as well. They're all mining and mining Bitcoin. And I think they're going to see that as a way to reduce waste. And I don't think they really care about their CO2 footprint. I think they're doing this as a way to monetize the stranded or wasted energy. Once they can monetize it and see that that process actually works and they're actually getting paid hard dollars for this Bitcoin that they're producing, they're going to then realize, hang on a sec, why don't we get paid in Bitcoin for the oil and gas that we produce as well and that we sell to the world? Because getting paid in Bitcoin is, you know, a much better currency to be paid in long term than the US dollar. And this is where the numbers get really crazy really quickly, in that you're going to have, excuse me, there's roughly $110 billion of global trade for oil on a daily basis. Now, if you've got the majority of oil producers globally only accepting Bitcoin for their oil, all of a sudden, that's $10 billion of daily demand, or the equivalent of 2.5 Michael Saylors entering the market every single day of the year in perpetuity. Like, all of a sudden, the price goes exponential very quickly when you have that much weight of money coming in to buy Bitcoin and hold it. So I think we're going to see the potentially the BRICS nations, who are the commodity producers, adopt Bitcoin first, because it's in line with their thinking and something that they understand, that they're getting a hard money for a hard commodity that they're producing. So I just hope that the US is smart enough to start buying and saving so that they maintain their, you know, their US dollar hegemony and, you know, their place in the world.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And it seems like there's already been kind of hints towards that, you know, the BRICS nations moving toward, not Bitcoin specifically, but, you know, trying to move away from the US dollar, right? They've kind of announced that they'll be accepting trade in various cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and things like that. So one, we haven't seen it happen yet, or at least, you know, not publicly. I don't know, maybe they have done it and we just haven't noticed yet, or what on the blockchain. That's maybe something we could verify, but it seems like that's kind of the way that we're going. So, you know, with, I guess, you know, not to get too political into things, but with obviously the war is going on in Europe, right? Ukraine, Russia, and the Israeli war going on as well. Do you think that these kind of geopolitical tensions, like all these kind of various macro factors all play a role in kind of accelerating us towards a potential of a Bitcoin standard, or more countries moving away from the US dollar into more of, you know, maybe a Bitcoin standard or a hard money type of standard with something backed by Bitcoin or something along those lines?
That's a tough question. I think everything's good for Bitcoin. For starters, whether it's good or bad for Bitcoin, it's all good for Bitcoin. Like, it's, I really don't like the geopolitical framework or setup that we've got at the moment. We've got two wars being fought now, you know, Israel and Palestine, and that's not really a war, but it's, you know, powder keg, you know, just absolutely waiting to go off. And then you've got the Ukraine and Russia conflict, which is, you know, I just, for the life of me, there've been so many people who've died in that conflict. I just want to see an end to it as quickly as possible, because there are no winners. And the problem is that, you know, that's an existential threat to Russia. And, you know, it's, there are no winners here. And it's just, it absolutely breaks my heart. And I'm not sympathizing with any of the parties here, but I just want a peaceful world. And obviously this is the hope that we have for Bitcoin, to bring in an alignment of interests and incentives that enable us to cooperate and live peacefully rather than to be at each other. I think we're going to have to see, sadly, a re-dollarization before we see a de-dollarization. And the only way to avoid that happening is to have almost an amnesty on the debt, a debt jubilee, where we just re-rate asset prices upwards dramatically. And this is one thing that I can see happening because everyone's talking about the debt spiral and, oh, we can't afford it and look how bad it is and, you know, we're, you know, this is a huge problem and the rest of it. But everyone, not everyone, I haven't heard anyone talk about the other side of the balance sheet. Now, how do you solve the debt problem? All you do is readjust the assets upwards dramatically. Like, you know, you 5x the asset prices and now all of a sudden the relative debt has dropped 80%. Now you've got to adjust, you know, that's the inflation argument, right? But, you know, you start by readjusting asset prices and then you solve the debt problem. So I think it's going to be a long time before people move away from the US dollar. I just don't see that happening anytime soon because as bad as it is, it's still much, like far, far better than say the Russian ruble, the Chinese yuan, the Indian rupee. Like, please, the Indian rupee, no one wants that. Yeah. And yeah, we don't have the stability on Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin's still volatile. If Bitcoin's going to go to the $10 billion that I think it is, it's going to be wildly volatile to the upside and no one can really trade in that.
Yeah, I agree. And you kind of mentioned like the re-dollarization and the debt jubilee of, you know, like current like asset prices. So I'd be remiss to not ask you, like, how do you think like, about like the current U.S. stock market has been doing very well this year, though it seems like there's a lot of cracks under the economy. U.S. real estate is kind of, I guess, holding steady in a sense where, you know, real estate markets kind of globally seem to be starting to crumble and kind of lead the way for the potential of, you know, the U.S. real estate kind of starting to shift. So in a sense, like, how do you think, overall assets, prices just like in the various sectors, whether it's, you know, the stocks or real estate, how do you think that's going to be affected in the next couple of years, to say the very least, with all the, you know, not only the conflicts, but, you know, the macroeconomic factors that we've kind of lined out here of the cracks starting to surface?
You know, that's a really broad question. And I think it's important to go through case by case what I think will happen across the board. Because it's going to be isolated. Like, there are going to be winners and losers in this. It's not across the board, hey, we, you know, it's a blow off top and everyone's happy. It's, there's going to be winners and losers in this. And I look at, say, some of the winners, I think, are going to be the growth stocks because they have very little debt. They've got huge amounts of cash sitting on their balance sheet. They've got growing revenues, growing margins. So they're great businesses to be in. However, they've obviously performed really well this year, but, you know, for the previous 2 years, they were absolutely sold off and oversold and, you know, really absolutely took a beating. But I look at that and I think, you know, those stocks, I think, have got significant upside in front of them because they don't have any debt. I think there's a curious thing happening here, which I haven't really heard anyone talk about. But and I think it's going to basically become very clear in the next 2 years that, say, in 2010, there was a rollover, there was a change from growth stocks to value stocks. And what I mean by this is up until 2010, a growth stock was defined by a company that had huge amounts of working capital, huge amounts of debt, and they're exceptionally sensitive to rate rises. So if the rates rose, the stock absolutely crashed. Now, value stocks were the ones that didn't have a huge amount of debt. They had great cash flows and they really worked like a bond yielding, you know, a certain return and everything was hunky-dory. Fast forward to 2010 and that growth stock slash value stock inverted on its head for two reasons. Firstly, you had the financialization of the value stocks, financial engineering to maximize the returns for shareholders. And at the same time, you had the growth stocks turning into really profitable businesses and hoarding huge amounts of cash with effectively zero cost per additional unit of production. So all of a sudden, growth stocks went from, you know, highly levered and all the rest of it to lowly levered or no leverage and huge amounts of cash. And at the same time, you had financial engineering happening in value stocks. So all of a sudden, I'm looking at what's coming up in the value stock world and think halfway through next year, it's going to get really interesting because this is where all the corporate bonds are going to roll over from a 2% to an 8% interest rate. And, you know, you've got 15% of the S&P 500 are effectively zombie companies when the rates are at 2%. What's going to happen when those rates go to 8%? They're either going to have to refinance or they're going to have to sell or they're going to go bust. So there's a day of reckoning coming in the next 2 years for a lot of those sort of middle of the road companies who have got, you know, who are highly levered and don't have, you know, sufficient cash flows to do that. The other thing which I think is really important to note is you've got value stocks which, and you've got a lot of companies in the US which undertook stock buybacks, and this has been just an absolute decimation of shareholder value. And the most egregious example of this that I cite is IBM. So IBM has had over $120 billion worth of share buybacks, and their market cap today, or last time I checked, is less than $120 billion. So how on earth does that work? I mean, that's crazy. Like, that is the definition of insanity. I'm like, so all of these things just don't add up. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, you know, that's the stock market. Then you've got the real estate sector. You've got the commercial real estate sector with not only the demographics moving against them, but you've got the interest rates moving against them, and you've got the floor falling out of the price. All of a sudden, there's just this air between the value and what you can actually sell it for. So someone's going to have to eat, you know, a big loss on that. I don't know who it is. Is it going to be the regional banks? Is it going to be the investors? I don't know, but there's going to be opportunities in that space. But, you know, the prices have to come down dramatically to look at that. So there's going to be winners and losers. This is what we look at on a daily basis to think, you know, where are the opportunities? But I can't help but look past Bitcoin, you know, for the next 2 years and think there's no other opportunity like that right now.
No, and I agree with you 100%. And it seems like a lot of people might be like kind of flooding their money away from the stock market into an asset potentially like Bitcoin, where, you know, people start to see the value in it. And, you know, I think it is, yeah. I mean, kind of interesting too. Like, we've seen essentially like 7 or 8 companies like hold up the entire S&P 500 this year. And it, you know, kind of the narrative around it is like, you know, I mean, is that everything's fine, right? I mean, you look at the US and a lot of the data that's reported is, you know, jobs data, it's survey based, and the surveys have like a 30% response rate. And, you know, it just seems like the writing's on the wall here, where the Federal Reserve is going to turn the corner and start to, you know, pivot back and lower interest rates too late. So, you know, one, like, I guess, as the Fed and Jerome Powell are kind of pulling these levers, so to speak, of the entire global economy, it seems like one, do you kind of think that, you know, one, that they're going to, you know, I guess, lower the interest rates too late? And two, like, I guess, how do you think the job that they're doing with this whole thing? I mean, you know, I personally don't want to be in that position, but it seems like they're very reactionary, and it's always too late.
I agree with you, but I think we're looking at it from a different prism to what they are. I don't think they're doing it because they want to slow the economy. There are far more effective ways to do it than what they're pursuing. And I look at it as a way to potentially bankrupt the ECB, to drain liquidity from the globe, to get that euro dollar system under control, which has been completely out of control. You had European banks, you had South American banks creating euro dollars willy-nilly, and all of a sudden the best interest rate that the world can get on the US dollars is, you know, in the SOFR market, secured overnight funding rate, you know, that's paying more than anyone else, and they give the best returns, and there's no counterparty risk. So I think we're looking at it from a very myopic perspective, thinking about our own situations and, oh my goodness, this is terrible. We've got to pay interest on X, Y, or Z. And I look at the Fed thinking they're playing a much bigger game. They're not worried about, you know, what's happening on the local perspective. They're trying to drain global liquidity and get all of that cash back onto American soil. So I think that's the meta game that's happening at the moment that we're unaware of. We're looking at our, you know, investment properties and stocks and the rest of it, thinking, oh, they've got to drop rates. It's like, that's assuming that they care about what we care about, but they might be playing a much bigger game where they're trying to get the US or the euro dollar under control on a global scale and, you know, thwart a central bank digital currency out of the EU. If that's the case, then we're going to have rates higher for longer and, you know, basically buckle up, because there's going to be so much pain, but the US is going to feel it a whole lot less than the rest of the world. And it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad for everyone, but I'd want my money in the US, and that's where most of our money is.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess that just kind of leads to the value proposition of Bitcoin, where it's essentially like taking the power out of the people, right? I mean, essentially with it, you know, that the halving cycle, everything's like built in, hard coded. So people can essentially, I guess, in a sense, prepare for what's ahead, opposed to the unpredictability of, you know, the Fed, as, you know, the market has been kind of screaming for a pivot, you know, this entire year. And then, you know, now it's obviously pushed back till next year. At first, the bond market market was saying September of next year. Now it's saying spring. So it seems like the market is very flip-flop and reactionary to that. So, I mean, obviously, you know, Bitcoin kind of taking the power out of the people seems to be almost like one of another cog here that, you know, I guess isn't really taken too much account for, where, you know, like leaving human error out of it. Do you see that as essentially like another value proposition?
I think it's the largest value prop for Bitcoin. And for me, you know, I work in a world of finance. Excuse me. I work in a world of finance where, in financial terms, the Federal Reserve is God. And let me give you three examples of, you know, what we hold as, you know, the highest of institutions in financial terms, which literally dictate and mandate what happens globally from all of their policies. But I think it was November 2021, we had two directors of the Federal Reserve step down for insider trading. Halfway through the next year, we had Jerome Powell telling us that inflation was transitory and he doesn't know how inflation's caused. Like, pardon the French, but fuck off. Like, you got to be joking. And then the thing, the real killer for me was nearly a year ago now, in December last year, we had the Philly Fed, which is a sub-branch of the Federal Reserve, come out and say that they had missed 1.1 million people who were unemployed from 6 months ago back in June. Now, I'm thinking there's three from three as far as the complete line through having ever being able to trust that organization ever again. And what we've seen with the jobs number, the inflation numbers, and the rest of it is they've given us numbers and then they've revised those numbers after the fact months later to accommodate a political agenda for whatever they want to accommodate. And it's like, I just don't believe anything they say now, because like that, you know, that joke, how do you know you've got a good accountant? You know, simply ask them, what's one plus one? If they're any good, they'll look around, they'll close the blinds, and then they're going to whisper to you very quietly, what would you like it to be? Now, all of a sudden, we have the Federal Reserve, our most trusted financial institution on earth, acting like a good accountant. And I'm like, that's not their job. They're not meant to do that. They're meant to pass that information objectively to us so that we can then make decisions. And so this is where, as a, you know, an investment advisor for many years, I look at this, I'm completely despondent, because for many years we've taken our cues from the information we've been able to gather from, you know, the Federal Reserve and what they're dishing out to us. And now to realize that it's all horseshit made up and they revise the numbers after the fact, I'm like, once people really are cognizant of that across the board, that that's really what's happening across every institution, including the financial ones that we trust and everything else, people will flood to Bitcoin. That's my expectation, because, you know, people just, you know what, I can deal with the truth. Just tell me the truth. I don't need the horse shit that you think I can't handle it. Just give it to me straight. That's what I want to hear. And this is where Bitcoin just tells you straight, this is what's happening and everyone can check it. So.
Yeah. And it seems like people are more and more waking up to the fact that, you know, the Federal Reserve, current people in power are lying to us. I think that's a little bit more, maybe it's the Bitcoin bubble that I'm in on Bitcoin Twitter, but it seems like those clips are starting to go more and more viral, even for people that I know and follow that aren't necessarily Bitcoiners. Maybe they're in the financial markets or something like that. So I guess from your perspective, from being, you know, kind of in the not fiat world, but the finance world, do you interact with a lot of people who are maybe not Bitcoiners, but kind of, I guess, on the edge on the financial world? And do you see there's a becoming of a more of an acceptance of Bitcoin in that space, opposed to maybe like a couple years ago, it seemed like everybody that was in the financial world was trying to dance on Bitcoiner's grave when it crashed to 4,000. But yeah, do you see like kind of more of an acceptance from, I guess, the traditional finance world?
You know what, that you raise a really fascinating point there. Like such a fabulous point. I'm like thinking about it and I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I see. And the reason why I see that is, you know, in sort of putting some thought to it, it's all of a sudden, you know, everyone used to dance on Bitcoin's grave and, oh, it's so volatile, I can't believe you're into that, you know, magic internet money and the rest of it. And all of a sudden it's like people are now starting to wake up to think, hang on a second. And it's not so much the fact that Bitcoin has grown in stature, which I think it has, but that everything in finance, everything in life, full stop, is relative to something. You know, you need to compare and contrast. And all of a sudden, Bitcoin used to be compared and contrasted to stocks, bonds, real estate. And stocks, bonds, and real estate didn't have an image problem. They were really good. They were sturdy. They were stable. There was no volatility, all the rest of it. Now, have a look at the carnage that we've just gone through in the last 2 years. We've seen the worst 2 years performance for long-term bonds. If you go back 240 years, there hasn't been a long-term bond market like it, like unbelievable. So all of a sudden, bonds are out. Properties, you know, commercial properties basically, well, colloquial term here, shat the bed. So, you know, all of a sudden that doesn't look so good. And then, you know, we've got the stock market, which is a tale of two cities, the haves and the have-nots. And all of a sudden, Bitcoin's just plodding along, doing its thing. And all of a sudden, hang on a sec, this actually doesn't look so bad when you contrast that to what is happening everywhere else. So I think that's a really great point, that maybe because of the volatility everywhere else, the volatility in Bitcoin doesn't look so bad.
Yeah, and I think that that's going to be kind of a continuing trend, because we're seeing like more financial terms, or financial firms, excuse me, get into it. We're seeing BlackRock, you know, going for the spot ETF. So I think, you know, everybody around traditional finance, you know, a few years ago was saying like, this is you know, the funny internet money, Bitcoin isn't worth shit, all that kind of stuff. And then now they're starting to, I think, get a little bit curious. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, obviously more people come to you in the next bull run, but especially more of these financial firms start to get maybe a little bit curious about Bitcoin. But there is a worry to me that maybe the financial firms take a peek behind the hood and look at, you know, maybe some of these altcoins, right? Some of the shit coins, and can see, I guess, maybe the variability that comes with that. So, you know, with, I guess, you know, just overall global ruling, right? It seems like the SEC is kind of in between. They're essentially claiming majority of shit coins are securities outside of Bitcoin. And how important is that, in a sense, from like a financial markets term, where, you know, we won't see maybe like, I don't know, I'm just throwing out banks, but like Goldman Sachs or somebody kind of trying to invest into Dogecoin or something like that, where, you know, then we start to get, you know, maybe high net worth people trying to do these pump and dump schemes. Like, how important was that ruling, and how important is the distinction between Bitcoin and crypto when it comes to the overall, I guess, financial markets? I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but it's just kind of, I don't know, a curious thought that I had here.
I think it's a good thought and nice to explore, because what it sort of tells me, I believe, in all that we've seen in the last 18 months with the regulations coming into Bitcoin, Bitcoin being excluded, Bitcoin being classified as a commodity by the CFTC, that gives this gives certainty around the regulatory framework that we need to work in. However, all of the other coins don't have that regulatory framework to work in. So it's going to be the domain of the hedge funds. It's not going to be the ETFs. The ETFs aren't going to be able to invest in that. So you're going to have hedge funds playing around at the edges. But this is where hedge funds have the ability to get burned really badly on this, and anyone who plays around in the altcoin market. So I think, you know, what we typically saw is, you know, in the last three cycles, we saw if Bitcoin went up, the altcoins went up substantially more. However, that was a function of the fact that people would ride Bitcoin up and then they'd sell, and then they'd go into altcoins and they'd ride that up and then they'd sell and then they'd come back to Bitcoin. That was the function of that market and how that worked. However, last bull market, that broke the cycle, because what you had was FTX loaning Bitcoins that they'd sold to Alameda. Alameda would take that Bitcoin, put it straight back onto FTX, sell it, and put sell pressure on Bitcoin, and then go and buy altcoins, which means, by my thinking, altcoins massively outperformed last market and Bitcoin massively underperformed. Now, you had 10 to 20% of global trade going through FTX, and they were doing that daily. Given that and that weighting and that little setup that was going on, I am shocked that Bitcoin even reached 70,000 last cycle. That is unbelievable that it did that, because price is determined at the margin. And when you've got 15% sell pressure, there's no way it should have got to 70,000. But it did. So I look at that. If we can root out that type of situation happening again, then you couple that with, you know, over the next 2 years, we're going to see a flood of money, hundreds of billions of dollars come in from the ETFs. All of a sudden, that ETF money can't flow into altcoins. And so the institutional money can't really play in the altcoin space. So I think this trade where people are going to want to try and trade altcoins because they go up faster isn't going to happen, because the money's going to stop at Bitcoin, because that's the only place it can go from an institutional level. You'll have traders trading around at the sides. You might have hedge funds doing that, but the institutional money stops at Bitcoin, and that's where the price, the major gains are taken out. So.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I feel like, yeah, that the price was definitely suppressed from, all this paper Bitcoin, FTX, like all the kind of bad actors. So it seems like those bad actors have kind of, I guess, filtered out by the wayside. So before I let you go, I want to ask one last question, and I'll take one from my friend BTC Sessions over there. So what makes you bullish going forward in the next, I guess, couple years? Obviously, we got the halving coming up, but there seems to be a lot of development on the side of things. So yeah, man, Peter, why are you bullish?
Oh, how can't you be bullish in this environment? Have a look at everything else that's going on in the world, and then you've got Bitcoin. Bitcoin is hope. Bitcoin's the opportunity. Demand supply, there's going to be just an overweight of demand for this asset, and the supply is running off the exchanges. It's the best opportunity I've seen in my lifetime, and I think the next two years is going to be fascinating, not only from a price perspective, a price action, but I think from a global perspective of adoption and enlightenment that Bitcoin's going to bring. So why am I bullish? We've got Bitcoin, that's why.
I love that answer. All right, Peter. Well, thank you so much. You've been very, very generous with your time. Why don't you tell people what you got going on and where they could find you?
Sure thing. Well, you can find me on Twitter at Peter BTC Advisor ER. We help people with collaborative custody and helping clients get Bitcoin off exchanges. So if you're having trouble doing that, or you don't know how to do it, or if you want to see a whole host of resources that will help you take action and control yourself, we have a website called thebitcoinadvisor.com, and that's advisor with an ER. There's a ton of resources there that will help you get started to do it yourself. And if you can't do it yourself, please reach out and book a time for us to help you. We'd love to help you do that.
For sure. And I'll put all of that in the show notes as well. So, Peter, thanks so much for your time, man.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun.